This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
You're listening to the Evening Edition with me, Umar Paganampake Pagan. Today on the show, well, what else is there to talk about, really? America has spoken, and in a stunning upset, Donald J. Trump will indeed be the 45th president of the United States of America. Shock. Horror. Over the next hour, I will welcome to the show a whole bunch of analysts and political thinkers and attempt some sort of dissection and analysis of what just happened. First up, Dr. Catherine Sanger is the vice rector at Yale NUS College in Singapore. Kate, what just happened?
Well, I think we're still grappling with that and trying to understand what happened. I think one of the things that's most telling about this election is that the result is being met with such confusion and befuddlement, really, on the part of many political commentators, political elites, and attentive citizens. And in some ways, that speaks to how disconnected many Americans have become from other Americans. The fact that this is happening and it's such a surprise potentially speaks to the fact that many of the people who see themselves as experts on American politics and experts on the American electorate seem to not be as in touch with that electorate as maybe they thought they were. And that speaks to the growing divide in the United States among different segments of the population.
Every election season, we're always hoping for a kind of systemic upset. That's what everyone talks about, right? You know, the outsider coming in and really throwing the system for a loop. I think a lot of people just didn't want it to be Donald Trump.
That might be true. I think if you look at, I'm not sure that there's that same, I'm not sure that I would characterize the election season as one where there's been across the board hunger for a real upset or something really new. I think there are many Americans who feel that President Obama was steering the country in a good direction, and that especially with a more cooperative and collaborative Congress, that was the sort of general direction that the country should continue to be headed in, and that 4 years in a Hillary Clinton administration could really even further move the country in that right direction. I think that there has been a lot of attention to an antipathy towards Hillary Clinton among some voters, some very vocal opposition, both those who ended up siding with Donald Trump, but also the people who had hoped that Bernie Sanders would be the Democratic nominee. But there has been a very strong and powerful intergenerational voice of people who not only don't want Donald Trump, but who actively wanted to see Hillary Clinton as president of the United States, who thought that she had the experience, the tenacity, the courage, and the vision to be a really effective president. And on top of that, to be the first female president.
And we saw those in the numbers as well. I mean, some early data shows that Hillary Clinton really won among young voters and millennials. Meanwhile, a lot of the people that were voting for Donald Trump were much older.
Yes. And I think one of the interesting stories that will come out of this is to see what happened with the millennial voters. Is it that they just weren't enough of a block to counteract a somewhat older part of the electorate? What role did third-party candidates play? This is something that is sort of a common trope of American politics, to turn to the third-party candidate and the people who voted for them and say, how could you? But it's often some very complicated sort of political analysis to figure out, okay, if third-party candidates got a good number of votes, where did they get those votes from? Because a lot of the people who vote for third-party candidates, it's not as though they were going to vote for Hillary Clinton, but then they voted for Jill Stein. Those were people who were potentially never going to vote at all for a more establishment politician. And so the only reason they voted is to vote for a third-party candidate. So you can't really lay the blame at their feet.
So should the question I ask be what went right for Trump or what went wrong for Hillary? Or is it a bit of both?
I would think that to understand what's happened here, we probably need to look at both the forces that propelled Trump to victory and also the forces that hindered Hillary Clinton, I think we'll be teasing those out in weeks and months and probably years to come. Many of these factors are difficult to isolate because they interact with each other. Class dynamics are clearly at the fore in this election, with people's income being highly correlated with their voting patterns. But we also see that class and gender interact in interesting ways. And so more educated, higher income earning man might think about gender in different ways than men with different backgrounds. And so trying to tease out how do the different forces come together is going to be a complicated project, and it's too soon to probably make those determinations.
You know, immediately after the Brexit vote, Rob Ford said that, you know, people were feeling like strangers in their own country. And he said that people voting for Brexit have felt that way for years. And it feels like there is something analogous to that, to what happened in America today.
I think what's happened in the United States has shown us that right now we're hearing a lot from people who had hoped that Hillary Clinton would win the White House. And the fact that Donald Trump is the president, appears to be the president from here on, signals to them that they feel like a stranger in their own country. But perhaps what's more interesting is that the Donald Trump phenomenon shows us that there is a group of Americans who have felt alienated within their own country for quite some time, but maybe been going under the radar. And that these are the people who feel that the American dream that they thought was coming to them hasn't, and they feel cheated enough to support a very unconventional, even uncomfortable candidate, because change is what they really see as the main route to getting them back on track, to getting the America that they want. The rhetoric of the Trump campaign of Make America Great Again speaks to this sense that there's this block of Americans who feel that the America that they thought they would grow up in has shifted away from them. And whether that's because of a perception that affirmative action policies are making it so that they're getting passed over for promotions while racial minorities and women are getting the jobs that they were supposed to have gotten, or because the income gap is widening and they're not able to have the lifestyle that they thought they would have, send their kids to the schools they thought they would be able to send them to, or a somewhat more amorphous vision of jobs going overseas or immigration, some of these senses of a threat to America and American economic vitality that is leading to a big block of Americans feeling like they're not in the America that they were promised.
So I want to get your thought on something, and it's this. I've had this theory. Throughout this election season, we've had Democrats tell Republicans that, you know, you're reaping what you sow with Donald Trump. Over the course of the Obama years, this misogyny, this arrogance, this bigotry and racism has been peddled towards the president. And therefore, what you end up is a candidate that speaks to all of that, right? But at the same time, I was thinking about it the other day, and I thought, you know, it's interesting where Trump is coming from, because something has been happening in America, I guess, over the last decade, and it kind of started over the last few years of the Bush presidency, in that this antagonizing of that white class of voter by making fun of them, by almost saying that, you know, their problems aren't real because they're white and privileged. And I think Trump cashed in on that. And am I right in thinking that, you know, Trump just spoke to that and said, hey, no, listen, your problems are real. I believe you.
I think it's extremely difficult to open up, you know, to peek inside of people's brains and try to get a real nuanced handle on some of the emotional drivers that seem to be at play in this election. But that strikes me as a very powerful thesis, that there's sort of a two-part interaction going on here. The first is people becoming increasingly desensitized to ugly language, whether it's you are operating in a more maybe democratic area and you're becoming desensitized to the way people are talking about Republicans. Of course, they're stupid or somehow, you know, intellectually flawed for voting Republican. And then on the flip side, rhetoric in more Republican-dominated areas towards Democrats as being of low moral character. You know, I think that the term "nasty woman" was really interesting. It showed that that kind of language was socially acceptable.
Yeah,
that we had become desensitized to a major party candidate on air referring to the opposition in that way. So I do think there's desensitization towards this ugly language, but it's going both ways. And there is, I think, a resonance to somebody saying, I'm not focused on minorities. I'm not focused on improving the lives of immigrants. I'm not focused on women and women's issues and children's issues. I'm listening to you. If you have felt that you have not been listened to in a while, that would be a very powerful message to receive.
So, Kate, one of the things that I found quite interesting is that we truly are in uncharted waters. In other Republican wins where, you know, the Republicans have maintained control of both the House and the Senate, what we've had is usually a very cohesive party. In this case, it feels like Trump has been so antagonistic to his own party that we have no idea how these next couple of years is going to play out.
I think this is a fascinating question. What is the lesson that other Republicans and Republicans who weren't necessarily that enthusiastic about Trump to begin with, what is the lesson that they're going to take from this electoral upset? If they take the lesson that they need to work even harder to preserve the Republican Party that they envision, then we could see them trying to, in some ways, contain and restrain Donald Trump in order to preserve the more traditional conservative Republican legacy. If, on the other hand, a number of Republican leaders, the lesson that they take is, we've got to get on this train, that the way to electoral victory in contemporary America as a Republican is to use this language, to adopt this and this extremely anti-establishment, provocative, potentially undemocratic approach, then I think the Republican-dominated Congress is going to hardly restrain Donald Trump, but more kind of unleash him more fully. So I think it's the question that we need to be looking out for is, what is the lesson that Republican elites are going to take from this election?
So one last question for you, Kate. What's next?
What's next? That's a great question. I think that if anything, we are learning that our powers of prognostication are probably limited. And so I don't want to make predictions that I can't be sure about. I do think that if I'd be very surprised if there isn't some significant soul searching in both the Republican and the Democratic Party. And we should also keep in mind that while we have had these two parties by these names for quite a while, the constitution of these parties has shifted over time. And some of the platforms that we now associate with the Democratic Party used to be much more affiliated with Republicans and vice versa. And so if we see some realignment between the parties, or even some schisms within and kind of molding of some new parties, I wouldn't be entirely surprised by that.
Kate, thank you so much for your time. I've been speaking to Dr. Catherine Sanger. She's the vice rector at Yale NUS College in Singapore. After this, I welcome Tijo, also from Yale NUS College, for a quick look at the role of gender and the media in this year's election cycle. Don't go anywhere. This is the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Beyond Frivolous Matters, BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
You're listening to The Evening Edition with me, Umar Paganampake Pagan, and on the show today, we're taking a look at what just happened in America. Donald Trump is the president-elect. What happened? How did everyone get their predictions so wrong? Joining me now from Singapore's Yale NUS College is Tijo, who is currently researching how media and gender play out in the different levels of the political system. So, T, tell me, I think one question that everyone is asking right now is how everyone got it so wrong. You know, I think up till 13 hours ago, almost every media outlet had Hillary Clinton leading by about 4 or 5 points.
Yeah, I'm going to speak to gender and how it has affected or has not affected this election more narrowly. Frankly speaking, I think that what happened was an underestimation of how far the white male and underprivileged white male demographic turned out to vote for Trump and against Clinton. The effect of gender thus is kind of minimized in my take on this. I think it has an indirect effect on the elections in general, but it was not the most decisive factor. And I think this underestimation is where most folks got it wrong.
So talk to me about this underestimation. I think it was Malcolm Gladwell who came out just a few days ago and said that Hillary's likability, or rather dislikability, was due entirely to sexism, right? And it was because she was a woman.
Right, right. Doubtlessly, gender has been a big issue in this campaign run up to now, and especially in the media. But I think that gender has mostly been an issue for, well, two obvious factors. One is the fact that a female has gotten so close to, or well, I guess got so close to the presidential seat of power. And the second is obviously the sexist and misogynistic comments that Trump has made on record. But I think it's not completely fair to say that gender, we don't feel okay talking about gender as a whole. I think media in general, if we talk about the main news channels, have been talking about media a lot. Even Fox News, which has traditionally leaned conservative, has taken a stance against misogyny and sexism this election cycle. What I think we see is how voters on the far right are rationalizing to themselves that, for example, the oft-quoted, this is just locker room talk, or this won't be how Trump will be like when he's actually president, which obviously begs the question, if you don't look at the track record, and
what do you look at, right?
Yeah, exactly. But nevertheless, if you look at exit poll data, for example, a lot of people have already made up their minds as early as before September. So for an America that is already polarized, I think that on the issue of gender, a lot of people have already taken like sides in a sense.
So the media has gotten quite a bit of criticism, and it's something I'm sure you've been following in their portrayal of Trump, in their ever willingness to give him as much airtime as he wants. And of course, you know, it's a ratings game for so many of them. What are your thoughts on how the media have behaved over this presidential season?
I think it's important not to generalize when we say media. I think that, for example, I would hazard a guess that actually a lot of voters right now are more influenced by their social media feeds than they are from the traditional media, in a sense. And as we know, social media is kind of self-regulated, but more importantly, self-selected and self-curated. So you tend to get articles that more likely already agree with your
point right.
on certain things. So I think the effect of social media is very big. As for the traditional media that I think you were talking about, ultimately, I think it's a vicious cycle. As you point out, ratings is one thing. So the media feeds into certain talking about agenda in certain established narratives. The narrative doesn't necessarily have to be stereotypes about women. It could be stereotypes about people talking about women, like, for example, that the people voting on the right are often sexist, for example. But it could also be talking about stereotypes that have already developed in the political campaign. As it reinforces stereotypes, I feel that it confirms for some voters what they already believe in. And because people on the ground tend to already select news channels based on their own political leanings, right voters will look at Fox and say, yes, that's probably true. And then they'll tune in more. And then they'll feed the kind of loop of information that's developing, and therefore concretize the narratives of gender that are developing in a polarized manner in the U.S.
Tell me about this, because when you were doing your research, what did you find regarding non-white voices and their representation throughout this race? Because in my exposure, I mean, I have to watch everything, right? CNN, Fox News, read all of that stuff. I still found a startlingly low amount of non-white representation. I mean, they weren't talking to enough brown people. That's what it felt like to me.
Well, I think it's not so much that we don't see certain minorities on TV as much as the way in which they're represented, or the way in which their opinions are valued or undervalued is uneven across the media spectrum. Obviously, on the very left side of the spectrum, if we want to say that, minority interests stand to have a larger voice. they tend to be at the top of like the consideration, especially if you look at, say, what the Clinton campaign has been releasing. Very targeted advertisements, for example, at specific minority groups like Latino or Hispanic targeted ads that are spoken in Spanish. And then after, I think, the Imran Khan incident with Trump, there was a targeted ad at American Muslims featuring Imran Khan and giving like his sort of spiel on the campaign and like what this means for him and his family. So I think that it's just uneven representation. In some cases, it will be more, and in some cases, it will be less.
T, thank you so much for your time and talking to us today.
Right, thank you.
That was T. Zhuo from Yale NUS College in Singapore. After this, Ray Buono and Carla Newman join me for more chit-chat and analysis on what just happened in America. This is The Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Bombing frustrated minds. BFM 89.9.
Good evening. You're listening to The Evening Edition, and we're back, folks. We're talking some more about what happened in America this morning. Now I've got with me Ray Buono, Carla Newman, Ezra Zayed joining me in this, in a world gone mad. Up is down, left is right. Cats and dogs living together.
Well, it, just for some reason at, you know, 7:35 this evening, and if you've been living and you've been busy the whole day.
And you've missed the news.
Donald John Trump was elected the 45th president of the United States in a stunning culmination of an explosive populist and polarizing campaign. We're here to dissect and perhaps put some sense to some of the events from early today.
Yeah. So, I mean, earlier in the show, we spoke a little bit about the kind of role that gender in the media played in this election. I was speaking to Dr. Catherine Sanger about white male America and the role they played in today's election. But today, Ray, let's start with you. I was hoping you would give us a little bit of historical context on what happened today, because this has been building up probably since Richard Nixon, right?
Oh, yes. I mean, I came of age in the late 1960s, and now it seems like I'm coming of age again in 2016. But I'd like to start with the idea that in 1968, in that campaign, Richard Nixon did two things. First, he created the silent majority, which was the first faint dog whistle to white Americans. And secondly, he activated the Christian right. So those two began the culture wars, which began to foment in the 60s and 70s. Then, skipping ahead, Ronald Reagan added the second ingredient, which was neoliberal economics, and the idea that the government should be shrunk to the size of a, I forget what it was, to die in the bathtub.
And that began the class war.
And that began the class war. So what you're seeing now is the result of those two wars, the class war and the cultural wars, coming together in the presidency of Donald Trump. But we also have to remind ourselves that it was the Clinton administration that also continued the class wars, took the Democratic Party away from the working man, and that the Obama administration, in the very first weeks, put Summers and Geithner in charge of the economy. So you had millions of people losing their jobs, millions of people losing their housing, and the Democrats never did anything. There was no one was arrested, no one was sent to jail.
And it's 8 years later, and they don't forget.
No, they don't, and you wouldn't either if you lost your house.
Yeah, it's been fascinating trying to look at some of those key battleground states, and I think what was one of the more fascinating things was trying to look at where Mitt Romney was from 4 years ago and some of the turns that Donald Trump managed to do. And
he exploded the map.
It was a very, very huge endeavor to begin with. But as the electoral votes started trickling in, you started to realize about 2 o'clock today that it was going to happen.
Absolutely.
Carla, you're from the South.
Yes, I am originally. No, it's interesting. I did a project in 2002 about bankruptcy in America, and it was never published, but it was fascinating because I just read a book which sparked it, which was Barbara Ehrenreich's Nickel and Dimed, and just basically about, you know, how many millions of Americans were not doing well in this myth of the middle class and that America was a middle-class country, I just felt wasn't true. And the huge explosion of bankruptcies, which later Elizabeth Warren fleshed out a bit after the Wall Street crisis, et cetera, I just always felt that there was this narrative that was out of sync with working class America and how much they were actually struggling. And the bankruptcy epidemic was a symptom of that. And that the mainstream media just wasn't covering it because most of them were from middle class suburbs.
And, of course, Donald Trump, having so many bankruptcies, felt
himself.
That pain.
He totally felt their pain. What does this mean for non-white people in America? Because I guess the rhetoric leading up to this last week of the election was that, you know, Obama coming out, Jay-Z and Beyonce coming out, Bruce Springsteen coming out meant working class, non-white people were going to get mobilized and fired up to vote.
Particularly Latinos and Hispanics. I mean, I have a friend who was mobilizing the vote for Hillary in Miami, and so they thought they could carry Florida on the backs of the Latino vote. But the fact of the matter is, I think Latino vote is so disparate and scattered. It's not just Mexicans in the U.S. You've got, you know, 15 different groups, of which are probably three major. And they don't agree. And they have different backgrounds, history, culture, et cetera. So there's very little they can actually agree on socially, politically, culturally. And then you've got the black vote, which they've shown was sort of plummeted since the last election when they all came out of the woodwork to vote for Obama, but they were just not excited by Hillary, despite her, you know, civil rights history, et cetera. There was just very little enthusiasm for this candidate.
And Ray, I mean, we were trying to, I guess, make sense of this particular candidacy, even from the primaries when it came to Donald Trump. He was the outsider, and the Republican Party just did not sort of come to terms with this particular candidacy. But when we look back even towards the end of the Bush era, we saw John McCain run up against Obama. We saw Mitt Romney come up against Obama again. And was it just a case of getting a candidate like Donald Trump to activate those necessarily elements to push him over 270?
I think it was, excuse me, I think it was Barack Obama that activated this racism, because instead of entering into a post-racial America, we actually intensified the racism.
Yeah.
So I think that's one factor that brought Trump. The other was that the Republican Party has always been a kind of unwieldy combination of the Tea Party types and the banker types. And Trump was able to split the Republican Party so that the banker types, like the Bushes and all of that, actually voted for Hillary.
That's right.
And so now we have a Republican.
And of course, that's what Hillary did, right? Because after the primaries, she didn't necessarily go after the Bernie voters. She went after the kind of centrist Republicans.
Exactly, exactly. And as a Bernie guy myself, I was appalled that she didn't accommodate the left wing of the Democratic Party. She didn't accommodate the millennials, who are now, you know, isolated and cut off from everything. And she went after the neoconservatives who ran the Iraq War. I think she got in a way what she deserved.
I think what's also interesting is the polls that we've been seeing. I don't care whether it's the past 24 hours or the past 6 months. It was hitting in one direction.
They were wrong.
And then the likes
they were
of
almost all wrong.
The likes of Nate Silver, of course, who made his name from the past two election campaigns, will probably be eating some humble pie at this point. But
I think Nathan has taken a job at a 7-Eleven.
But is that something that, I guess, looking at the media's role and polls, it feels so disjointed.
Maybe the mainstream media is irrelevant now. I mean, people go to their own sources. You know, they don't need the mainstream media to tell them how to vote or what to think anymore. And so in a sense, it's a chattering class. Maybe it's just talking to itself. And so the fact that so many people were surprised by so many angry white people, how many times had they been out of, you know, New York or Washington, and lived on minimum wage, and, you know, raising kids and trying to find childcare, and I mean, very real problems, I think, that people have. And so in that sense, I think there was just a huge disconnect.
Again, we're talking about class warfare. We're talking about people who live from paycheck to paycheck, have no money saved for any kind of a medical emergency, have no money for education. And we have a group of young people, and I think this is interesting to me, because one of the things I was very grateful for is that I grew up at a time when education was affordable. And even though I had a loan, it was a federal loan, no interest. If I taught for 5 years, half the principal was forgiven.
Mm. Right.
Now you have college kids coming out with 40, 50, 100,000 debt.
I had 200,000.
Yeah, oh, my God. Yeah. You know?
Yeah, and so people just feel like the American dream isn't for them anymore.
No.
And I think people don't believe the promises that they were given. So I thought it was interesting when Trump came out and supposedly told black people that they had nothing to lose by voting for him. But I think he was really talking to white people saying, well, it couldn't be worse than this.
Yeah, it can't get any worse for you. And I think that's still the biggest factor, I think. I think this idea that over the last 8 years and then 10, over the two last years of the Bush administration, we've seen it take root and even in popular culture. This idea that these people are hicks, that they're stupid. Mm-hmm. Let's laugh at
the
them. Let's make
of
fun of them.
Yeah.
The flyover states. The flyover states.
But it's gotten even more amplified.
It's sneering. It's just it came across as sneering.
And there's only so much they can take. And when you ignore these people's problems, because for them, it's very real.
Yes.
Yeah. And here comes a guy who goes, hey, your problems are real, man. I feel you. Even though I'm a billionaire from New York.
Yeah, but let's not forget there's a racial and a racist element to this, okay? And let's not forget what Donald Trump said about Hispanics, what he implied about blacks.
Correct.
And let's talk about Muslims, okay? Because I'm glad I'm not a Muslim in America right now. I'm terrified of what's going to happen to them. And also, let's talk about the fact that the police all over the United States, all the way up to the FBI, have been polarized in a way that will probably affect their behavior against minorities, dark-skinned people.
And I think also just on the role of gender as well, and the candidacy that Hillary Clinton represented. I mean, we've been talking about Hillary Clinton potentially being the first female president, breaking through that glass ceiling. And we heard that at the convention speech.
It didn't excite the electorate.
The hardest, highest glass ceiling, right? Mm-hmm.
It did not excite people. And so in that sense, there was this historic election that so few people were actually interested in. And the language she used didn't appeal to younger women. Mm. It wasn't their fight. They didn't want to be reminded about what a trailblazer Hillary was and everything she'd done for them. And
Despite the misogyny that Trump represented, that perhaps wasn't enough, I guess.
Well, I think people are willing to overlook fiery rhetoric when they think something more basic and instinctual is at stake. And so if you look at survival, well, you can, if your boss is groping you, is that, it's still a paycheck. You still got a roof over your head and bills to pay. So I just think a lot of women just turned a blind eye to the more uglier aspects of his, shall we say, experience with women and his history, because they're looking forward. And if he can do something for them that, Obama couldn't, well, then that's worth a shot. And I think there's a moment when people are in an election booth, right? And they're about to vote, when there's just this pause as the finger is about to go on the button, and somehow that finger just strayed. They just couldn't bring themselves to press for Hillary.
Awesome. All right, folks, we're going to continue our analysis of the American presidential elections. In the studio with us is Ray Buono, as well as Carolyn Newman, and my co-presenter Uma Paganapagay-Pagan. More after this on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Best flipping moments. BFM 89.9, the business station.
It's Uma and Ezra on the Evening Edition. In the studio with us is Ray Buono and Carolyn Newman as we take a look to dissect the results of the U.S. presidential election 2016. Donald Trump has been elected the 45th president of the United States. And, of course, he's won over a lot of white voters to ensure that they can make America great again.
Yeah, unfortunately, folks, you can't actually change the channel. this is real. All hail God Emperor Trump. Let's talk about the outsider element, because that was an element that played throughout this election. When I say outsider element, I mean here for the first time in American history, you have a president who has had no experience in government. He has never served in the military. It's also likely that he's never paid any taxes.
Well, that didn't stop Bush Jr.
That's right. That's right. Well, he did have government experience, though. I mean, he was governor. Yeah. So
even conceding that
Texas,
point
of a republic
of Texas, of their own republic.
There's some governance there. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, that is a big element. But I think part of that too is there's just a sense of a loss of American power overseas, prominence, eminence, whatever. So I think this whole sense of loss that people have felt about their status, whether it's as a, you know, as a people, as a nation, as a primary wage earner, as, you know, wanting to do better than their parents. I think, you know, there's a couple generations now that maybe are doing worse than their parents. And so that's an American dream that I think many people don't want to give up on. So in that sense, Trump is offering, in a way, you know, triumph of fear over hope. But in a way, it's a hope for something different, even if it's not necessarily better. It's something new.
Yeah, fear Trump's hope.
I mean, drain the swamp. Apparently that wasn't Trump's own words, but it's so evocative. I mean, the Tea Party started this, right?
Yes.
It was just that was largely confined to Congress, the House of Representatives and the Senate. And so in that sense, and some people feel it's a failed movement, but this is a direct result of that grassroots swell that, again, surprised the establishment, but maybe the establishment didn't respond adequately to.
Well, the Tea Party wasn't necessarily a failed movement because they became mainstream Republicans.
The last time I was on BFM talking about Trump, I mentioned Freud. Excuse my coughing, by the way. But I think in some ways there's a link between especially the white male who's now losing his potency in everything, in economics. They tend to be more my age, so they may be losing other potency as well. And along comes upwardly thrusting Donald Trump.
Donald Trump at 17.
Who talks about making America great again, if you will. And I think in some ways the loss of power is not just a loss of economic power, but it's a loss of almost sexual power.
Well, if I can go back a bit, you know, just to someone who grew up during the Reagan years and was born in the Cold War and all of that, the whole specter of cozying up to Russia, and it's just completely turning everything on its head that we were taught to believe about who was our enemies and our status in the world and all of that. And so it's just so many interesting aspects of this.
But also Vladimir Putin is macho as they come, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the thing. If we look at, I guess, from a global perspective as well, when Brexit took place, there was almost immediately after the results were announced, there was this huge glance towards the United States saying, by the way, Nigel Farage, UKIP, that's what they managed to do. And I wonder if that almost emboldened the constituencies in the United States to say, you know what, this can be done.
Well, but no matter what Trump does or doesn't do, the demographics of America are not going to change. And so for people who feel like, you know, I mean, Trump was endorsed by the KKK, and it's the first major presidential candidate to do so. And so in that sense, it does reveal something about what people feel they're losing about their identity and their culture. And so the town that my grandparents settled in Florida and the neighborhood that they grew up in, it's not white anymore. Mm. And my uncles and family, I think, you know, have a strong sense of loss.
But wasn't the case that when Obama won the campaign in 2008 and 2012, the lessons learned was that the GOP needed to reach out to new voters? At the end of the third debate, all we kept hearing was that Trump wasn't winning new voters in to close that 7-point gap. And it seems like against all the punditry and commentary that was suggested, his initial game plan to strip it down to a very simple message seemed to resonate with this audience.
And also one target, right? I mean, he said, he said, forget the gays, forget the blacks, forget the Latinos, forget the women, essentially.
Right.
He said, let's go. And it worked.
But also, Hillary never appealed to the people that Trump was going to. She never went after the factory workers. She never went after the people in Michigan. She didn't even go to Michigan.
And Obama took Michigan by 70% of the vote last time.
And Obama went to Michigan this time as well, but it didn't work.
And was the calculation on Hillary's camp that it was already locked in and that she was just going in for more Republican votes, those Bernie Sanders votes? Is that potentially what the strategy was?
That's what I think happened, was that she decided to tack, like her husband did back in the 1980s, to tack to the right and to triangulate. She thought by getting all these Republicans on her side, including, as I said, the people who brought you the Iraq War and Henry Kissinger, and I could name it, you know, that that would help. That would be a winning combination. Meanwhile, Trump went after the workers, the dispossessed, which should have been the Democratic Party's constituency.
Are your people. They were your people. Yeah.
Well, but, you know, Dixiecrats were always essentially Republicans hiding out in the Democratic Party. And, you know, there's a tiny and disappearing wing of the Republican Party which agree on certain social issues and compassionate conservatism and all of that. So they tried to cross over, but they never really got there.
Yeah. Ray, I wanted you to comment on one last thing. I mean, this victory, this win by Trump changes the American discourse and rhetoric in a big way, I think, because the people who voted in the majority, these aren't the people that necessarily fought for equal rights. They aren't the people that fought for social change.
Goodbye political correctness.
Yeah, well, that's in a sense the sad thing, because I think the people, the whites who voted for Trump, have been cultivated not to go for social issues, not to vote on... The Democrats should have been courting on social issues, should have been courting these people, and instead they ignored them, and Hillary had her speeches for Wall Street and her parties with Wall Street, and everything was from Martha's Vineyard, not from Ohio, certainly.
Folks, we're going to head to the news very, very shortly, but just wanted to get your thoughts, or I guess looking into a crystal ball. Final thoughts about what a Trump presidency looks like when January 20th happens. What can we predict?
It's going to be restrained, subdued, subtle, classy.
and no hint of gold.
Not a single hint of gold.
Yeah,
the White House will never be the same.
No.
Yeah. It'll be a fascinating ride. And in a sense, you know, this is a perfect, in a way, election for America. And it's a country of extremes. It's a country that likes to be entertained. It's a country that takes risks. And in a sense, we got the president that we wanted. So let's just see what happens. It'll be a wild ride.
Final thoughts, Ray?
I want to quote from Antonio Gramsci. An Italian socialist, communist, who said, "The crisis consists precisely in the fact that the old is dying and the new cannot be born. In this interregnum, a great variety of morbid symptoms appear." And I think that's what's happened. The old is dying, but the new, we don't know what the new is going to be.
My prediction, the Trump presidency will be live and broadcast 24/7 for the next 4 years.
Well, never let a crisis go to waste.
Carla Newman, Ray Bohner, thank you very much for joining us on today's analysis of the American presidential elections. It's been the evening edition, folks. Uma and Ezra signing out for now. It's BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9. The Business Station.